They were never number one either because of Do They Know It's Christmas? So it's right that they were number one once, but it looks like they're going to look like they're going to be number one again until Kylie Minogue came along this year, and there's actually a race this year. Her song Xmas looks like it is going to be number one. It's 7,000 units ahead as we speak, but Wham may well catch up in the last few days before Christmas number one's announced on Friday.
Kylie versus Wham. Okay, you've got to hear Kylie. Come on. Groove.
You've got some moves.
Oh, I didn't realise you could see me, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, damn it. I'm now going to put my suit on and relax.
Hands on your lap, yeah.
Matt, thank you so much for that. That was a great moment. We should do more of that. That is it from me today. I'm going to be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow, hopefully, with the final Christmas music of the year. But up next on Times Radio, it is Rosie Wright and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Trevor, thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
And in our programme today, can women trust the police? It's the question the policing minister failed to answer with a resounding yes this morning on Times Radio. We'll investigate why that is. There are calls to halt the appointment of the incoming Archbishop of Canterbury. She is accused of failures on safeguarding after allegations aired on Channel 4 News. And Cathy Newman will be on just after 3 o'clock to tell us more. Andrew Billen has spent 40 years writing brilliant interviews for The Times. He's our guest after 3:30. We're going to peek behind the curtain. And in the age of sat-nav, why is the famous London taxi driver test the knowledge only getting more popular?
All of that to come. But first, let's get the latest news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Rosie. Thank you. Sir Keir Starmer has called the resident doctor strike in England, which started this morning, dangerous. At Prime Minister's questions, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, asked him why he isn't being tougher.
This shouldn't be allowed. We already ban strikes by the police and the army. Why doesn't he put patients first, show some backbone and ban doctors' strikes?
Mr. Speaker, let me be clear about the strikes. They're dangerous and utterly irresponsible. And my message to resident doctors is don't abandon patients, work with us to improve conditions and rebuild the NHS.
The British Medical Association says the government can and must offer a bigger pay rise. The strike will last for 5 days. People will now be arrested if they chant "Globalise the Intifada" at pro-Palestinian marches in London and in Manchester.
We know communities are concerned about placards and chants such as "Globalise the Intifada." And those using it at future protests, or in a targeted way, should expect the Met or Greater Manchester Police to take immediate action. Violence acts have taken place. The context has changed. Words have meanings. Words have consequences. We will act decisively. We will make arrests.
The Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, says while the chants previously have not met prosecuting thresholds, officers will now use updated guidance after the Bondi Beach shooting in Australia. Intifada is the Arabic word for rebellion and has been used to refer to Palestinian uprisings against Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. However, some Jewish groups consider it an anti-Semitic call to violence. The Duke of Marlborough has been charged with intentional strangulation. Charles James Spencer Churchill, who is also known as Jamie Blandford, is a relative of Sir Winston Churchill and Princess Diana. The three offences are from between November 2022 and May 2024 and refer to the same victim. Sir Keir Starmer says the government has provided a licence to transfer the proceeds from the sale of Chelsea Football Club to humanitarian causes in Ukraine. The Prime Minister says he's willing to take legal action against former owner Roman Abramovich to release the £2.5 billion. The Russian billionaire wants some of the money to go to Russia so it can fund, in his words, all the victims of the war. A 15-year-old boy has appeared in court charged with the murder of a 9-year-old girl in Somerset. Aria Thorpe died after suffering a single stab wound on Monday in Weston-super-Mare. Police say they're working with schools and other agencies to provide support. Here is Superintendent Jen Appleford.
The tragic loss of such a young girl has caused a huge amount of shock and upset, with there being a profound sense of loss felt throughout our community.
And in cricket, the company behind Australia's video review system has admitted operator error meant an Australian batsman wasn't called out when he should have been in the Ashes. Alex Carey went on to get another 34 runs after seemingly being caught out, but was spared by a mistake on Snicko. The technology's accuracy has been brought into question before in this series. After day one of the third test, Australia are 326 for 8, and England must win to keep the series alive. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, welcome aboard. It's 4 minutes past two. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright with you this afternoon until 4 o'clock. We very much enjoy your company, so I hope you can stay with us until that time. We have an absolutely packed programme for you today. We're going to start with this simple fact that it should be an absolute given that as a woman or a girl, when you see a police officer, you feel safer. But we're going to start the show by hearing from Reclaim the Streets about the policing minister's acknowledgement that this simply isn't the case. We will also hear after 3 o'clock this afternoon from Cathy Newman about what happens next for the incoming Archbishop of Canterbury. A member of the General Synod has now accused her, Sarah Mullally, of failing in her duty over the way she handled a dossier containing unverified allegations. There really isn't a journalist in the country at the moment who hasn't done more than Cathy Newman on this story. She absolutely knows what's happening, and it will be a pleasure to hear from her. Has the taxman stolen Christmas? The allowance for festivities has not kept up with inflation, and this could mean that the photocopier may well be switched off at the office party. We've got Santa on the programme, and kids, don't worry, he is very busy at this time of year, but we don't know a Santa Claus who isn't happy to spend a couple of moments on speech radio at this time of year, and then we will let him get on his way. In these days of sat-navs, it might surprise you to know that more and more people are still taking the knowledge, the incredibly complicated test that London taxi drivers have to go through before getting their badge. So why would that be when you can simply plug in Waze and off you go? All your telly comes from Scott Bryan, all the tech comes from Chris Stokel-Walker. I told you it was busy. And our big guest after 3.30, Rosie.
This is going to be brilliant. We are turning the tables and interviewing one of the best interviewees. This is Andrew Billen, who you've heard many times on this programme. He's the features writer for The Times, who's this year interviewed politicians, celebrities, writers, whether it's the Green Party leader Zach Polanski on really polarising politics, the comedian Paul Merton on his heartbreak after his wife died, and then how it was to find someone else to then share your life with, the playwright Tom Stoppard. It's going to be a behind-the-scenes look at some of the biggest interviews he's done the last year and actually what happens, some of those quite, at times, tetchy negotiations when you're trying to get an interview in the first place. And it might be, and I know you've had much experience of this on this programme, that someone's celebrity PR says, look, they can come on, but we'll talk about only this one thing, their latest book, and nothing you want to discuss.
Oh, God, so much so, Rosie. So we've talked about this quite openly on the podcast. There's no reason why we shouldn't mention it here on the programme before. But it was going to be our pleasure to welcome Jerry Halliwell onto the programme. So she is a novelist and she's written, I think, two or three books aimed at young adults. So she had a new book out. So that's great. Of course, you want to talk about that. But she's Jerry Halliwell. So you really want to talk about everything else in her life too.
The Spice Girls.
Her
husband.
Yeah, and there was a lot going on in both those camps, actually, at the time. And, you know, we are issued with quite strict instructions about places we can go in the interview and places that we can't go. And it therefore ends up being so frustrating for the listener when they think, oh, it's Jerry Halliwell. You know, I grew up with this woman in my life and I want to know this and I want to know that. For them not to be able to hear a single question, or really an explanation as to why there isn't a single question. So I don't want to pick on her at all because I thought she was absolutely fantastic and we had a really lovely chat. I liked her way, way more than I thought I was going to. But to the PR world, Who are you doing the favour to, really? Nobody comes out of that looking good, least of all your client.
So Andrew Billen has wrestled with this dynamic many times. He'll be live in the studio with us in an hour and a half to tell us sort of the tales of what happens and how many different locations these interviewers have to pick, because it's often sort of at a coffee shop or a breakfast bar, and you sort of get to see, you want to see someone in more of a sort of normal habitat, don't you, to actually get underneath their skin.
Oh, you just want to use their bathroom.
Yeah,
that's what you want, isn't it? Because you can pretty much tell, you can tell everything, I think, by opening the cupboard in somebody's bathroom. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon, in at number three, a guide to K-pop demon hunters by our eight-year-old expert. It's Netflix's most popular film ever, with 236 million views. And if you're not quite sure what it is, look no further than that article. The second most read story, incorrect Alex Carey reprieve was our fault, says Snicko operator. The Australia batsman was given not out after a review in the third Ashes test. He went on to make 106 runs. Those responsible for the technology have now admitted that was an error. And the most read piece on the Times website so far today, Duke of Marlborough charged with intentional strangulation. Charles James Spencer Churchill, a relative of Sir Winston Churchill and Diana, Princess of Wales, is accused of three offences between November 2022 and May 2024. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, cheer from the back. Get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It's 10 minutes past two. The policing minister this morning failed to say that women can fully trust the police. Sarah Jones made the comments to Times Radio Breakfast ahead of the release of the government plan to deal with violence against women and girls. Well, Kate McCann challenged the minister over failures to investigate sexual violence. She asked Sarah Jones directly if women and girls could trust the police.
So I would say to victims that they have to do what they feel is the right thing for them to do. We are improving the system. Of course, there is a huge way to go. We have said, the Home Secretary said at the weekend, this is a national emergency. So we are putting in place, for example, domestic violence experts in all our 999 call centres. We are setting up specialist rape units in each police force. We are investing millions of pounds to manage perpetrators so that we are bearing down on them and making sure they don't reoffend. And the wider strategy that we'll publish tomorrow, of course, will go even further to make sure we can stop the problem in the first place by preventing boys and young men from going down the
wrong
path.
But I've just asked you, you're the policing minister. I've just asked you if women can trust the police. And you said,
Of course.
Well, you said women should do what they feel they need to do.
That's in terms of reporting crime. I'm not going to tell a victim of a crime what they should or shouldn't do. Of course, we should trust the police. I trust the police. I would, of course, want every single perpetrator of a crime, and particularly these vicious, nasty crimes, to face the full force of the law. That's what we all want. But we know that for multiple reasons, victims often don't come forward. We want to make that easier for people to do. And of course, we should trust the police. But we know we have a long way to go. And I don't think anybody is arguing against that. And that is why we are going to use the full force of the state to bear down on this crime with the biggest strategy we have ever seen coming tomorrow.
There's lots for us to get into there. Listening to that is Jamie Klinger, the Campaign Director for Women's Safety, co-founder of Reclaim These Streets. Jamie, thank you very much for talking to us. The sort of key word there, I think, that sticks out in what Sarah Jones said is that we should trust the police. She didn't sort of categorically say we can. Why do you think she made that distinction?
I think it's one of the most honest things I've heard from a politician in a really long time. The truth of the matter is that reporting to police is not an easy process. Getting believed by the police and then getting through the criminal justice system is incredibly, incredibly hard to do as a victim. And as it stands, they take the victim's phones, they take your therapy records. And that's if you even get past the police believing you. And then you're talking about a 4 to 5 year wait and a 1.7% conviction rate if you're raped. So I think odds wise, it's a really honest thing to say. I don't expect people to say it, especially in the last 5 years of campaigning, which has been pretty painful. But would I go to the police, given what I've learned and given what's happened since Sarah Everard was killed? We've got like the Angelini review. We've got the Casey review. We've got all of these things happening that says this is the roadmap to make it better for women. And yet none of them have been implemented. So I know they keep telling us, yes, everyone should report. Everyone should do this. Everyone should do that. But when you talk about the facts of prosecution and conviction rates, it's 1.7%.
What the minister said this morning is we've got a long way to go here. It was 2 years ago. You mentioned the Casey report. The Met Police said they were institutionally racist, misogynistic, homophobic. They announced a fairly big turnaround strategy in response. And today they've appointed Dr. Gillian Fairfield to review their progress. If we sort of take the last 2 years and the action and the strategies that have been implemented by the Met to tackle this, by their own admission, there is a problem of trust in police. Do you think things are improving?
I don't really, because like the Angelini review, which came after the Casey review, part one, they've just announced part two last week. Part one hasn't been started. And so this is where I really struggle is they'll do anything they can to get it off headlines, to make us not talk about it on the radio. But when it comes down to going back in and going line by line of these were the recommendations, what have you done against them? Very little has changed. And Mark Rowley reduced the entire Casey review to saying that he doesn't accept the systemic racism, sexism, and homophobia. And that's the thing. If you don't recognize and you're only doing the reform within and you don't believe that you really need the reform, it's never going to happen. And that's what I really respect from the policing minister this morning is to say it's not good enough. It is an emergency. Violence against women perpetrated by men is an emergency for women in England and Wales.
And the Home Secretary used that word exactly over the weekend. Shabana Mahmood said it was an emergency. And it's interesting you think it's not a priority to actually fix this rather than you think sort of a PR operation to get it off the front pages.
Well, I mean, look at the budget. The budget does not mention it. So they're having the biggest strategy they've ever had for violence against women and girls, yet they didn't mention it in the budget, yet there's not more money. They're saying the crack teams of police that are going to deal with online abuse have to be found from within. Like, the numbers don't add up, and we've waited. We're 10 months late on this strategy. So I, along with you, await to see what gets said, but more so, I await to see some results because in my experience of dealing with reform and dealing with the groups in violence against women and girls, we're quite disappointed by what we expected versus what's been delivered.
What would, for you, make a material difference to you and your colleagues and your friends and other women feeling as though they could trust the police? What reforms would you like to see?
So Operation Soteria went all up and down the nation and teaches them step by step how to make the reporting process much more about the perpetrators and not the victims. So what is the perpetrator's history of sexual violence rather than the sexual past of the woman that's been attacked? And there's all of these different ways that you take those reports, that you welcome a woman into a station, that you sit them down, the amount of time they wait, what the way that they're questioned, the timing and the pronunciation of how you lay out their cases. And they cut the funding. They did half of it and then they cut the funding. And so I hate to sit in despair, but I'm really disappointed that the roadmaps are there, the groundwork has been done, but until they actually follow up on it and do it step by step, I think we're going to be in this state of emergency for a much longer time.
Ultimately, the police by consent. I wonder if you think that is at risk.
I think it's more than at risk. I think when the Parliamentary Diplomatic Protection Unit can't find the rapist and the hideous criminals that are sitting across the desk from them, let alone the ones on the street, I think we're in a real problem. If we're arming these men and nobody up and down the Met has paid for those, I want to know every police officer and every supervisor that said no further action to David Carrick's victims. You know, you've got 18 years there, but yet we have a police commissioner who says in his 30-year career he's never seen any misogyny. Well, then his eyes aren't open.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been brilliant to have you on, Jamie Klinger, from Reclaim These Streets, I should say. In the announcement that the government made today, Jess Phillips, the Minister for Safeguarding and Violence, said for too long, these crimes, talking about violence against women and girls, is a national emergency. For too long, those have been considered a fact of life. That is not good enough. We will halve it in a decade.
This one in from Steve, who is one of our regular listeners. It's a bit of a trick question, he says, isn't it? Can women trust the police? Well, in the main, yes, women should undoubtedly trust the police. But the police isn't just one person or one individual. It's multiple organisations made up of thousands of officers, many of whom are dedicated, caring individuals. Are there some bad apples? Of course, there are bad people in all organisations. But it shouldn't mean that people shouldn't place their trust in the police. There will always be high-profile cases where things go tragically wrong, but that shouldn't deter from the great work many officers do. And I say that as someone who, in a former life, used to work for the police. Steve, I'm sure you're right in everything that you say, but the massive problem, I think, for so many women and girls now is that nobody wears a badge to say, I'm the good police officer. And nobody wears a badge to say, I might need investigating further down the line, or a badge that says, I'm a bad apple. So it is just a truth that the bad apples have spoilt the fruit bowl. And once you take away that faith that you have, that if you're in trouble, the person in the uniform is the person who will help you out. And you're absolutely right, Steve. It's masses of organisations. It's all the way through the criminal justice system. If you think I'm going to report this crime, but actually I know the statistic is, you know, between 1% and 3% of rapes secure a conviction, then all of that is going to inform your choice in the moment about who you trust with your story.
I also wonder the impact that stories like this have on people working in the police. The rest, if we sort of continue using that analogy, the rest of the people in the fruit bowl. And it must be demoralising if you have decided that you want a career to protect people, make the streets feel safer, make women and girls feel safer, deter crime, to have those high profile cases that completely undermine the work that you are trying to do. I think morale in the police force when stories like this break must be pretty miserable.
If you have experience of this, we would love to hear from you. 0333 003 3353. Just like Steve, if you've lived the life, then we would really, really appreciate hearing from you. Coming up, why your Christmas party might see the tax man come your way. Oh, joy of joys. It's 20 past two. Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Aisha Hazarika on Times Radio.
Trusted quality reporting from the heart of Westminster.
I've actually just hot-footed it from Parliament. I sat in for the first hour or so.
From momentous world events to everyday life.
Over the next hour, we'll be talking to the man behind the TV show that everyone has been talking about, and I mean everyone.
And the views that need to be heard.
This kind of standoff is not good for doctors, it's not good for patients, it's not good for the whole of the NHS.
Aisha Hazarika, every Friday afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
What good is sitting?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at KitKat.club.
This festive season, it's your turn to be crowned best gift giver and most imaginative host with a little chocolate magic from Hotel Chocolat. From tipples and desserts reimagined in chocolate form to reefs you can nibble, or two-foot-long crackers bursting with imaginative chocolates. You'll find everything you need to captivate one and all this season, in-store and online at Hotel Chocolat.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, if you want a sneak preview of tomorrow's Times front page, if you tune into Times Radio at 10 every evening, you can. Every night here, just after 10 o'clock, we bring you the front page before it's published. Then, a little bit later, at 10:30, we go through all the papers with a fantastic panel of reviewers. So you really do get ahead of the news just as it's broken. That's every evening here on Times Radio.
I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes.
So Ryan has just buzzed in my ear and said, whenever you're ready. Now, Ryan.
Christmas is all around me.
Okay, have you experienced watered-down cocktails and subpar picky bits at your work's Christmas party? Well, the Scrooge-like spending cuts may be down to tax allowances for festive celebrations not increasing with inflation. The allowance was last increased from £75 to £150 in 2003 when the Richard Curtis film Love Actually came out. We're joined by Holly Mead, finance expert. Hello, Holly.
Good afternoon.
I didn't even realise, and this is because I don't run a company, obviously, that there was an allowance specifically for Santa activities.
Yes, but there are a few rules about it. So I'm not sure why the tax office wants to encourage companies to host a Christmas party, but I am all for it. So your company gets a £150 allowance per person to host an annual event. Now, that's not an allowance in that the government's going to give them that money, but it's a tax deductible thing for the company. So they can effectively put that as a loss on the company profit sheet at the end of the year and sort of save a bit of money that way. It's a sort of strange backwards incentive. But yeah, you're right. In 2003, that allowance was doubled to from £75 to £150. And it's not changed since. And we all know that the cost of living has gone up an awful lot since 2003. So if it had tracked with inflation, the allowance now would be £279 per employee, and we'd all be having much better Christmas parties, no doubt.
We certainly would. And now, I've just never really heard this discussed before. I mean, could you claim this as an exclusive yourself, Holly?
No. So, and also, as an employee, it doesn't really affect you because you can't claim that tax back, and you also can't say to your employer, I don't want to come, can I just have the money instead? Although, that would be a great trick. But it's a good one for anyone running a company to know, because if you breach the rules, you lose your tax deductibleness on it. So if you even spend £1 on one staff member over that limit, the entire party becomes liable to tax. So that could end up being a very costly mistake. And also, it can't just be a one-off event. It has to be an annual event. So you can't say, you know, we've been going for 20 years and we're just going to do a party this one Christmas, which is a bit of a strange stipulation, because maybe it is that the company couldn't afford it in the first couple of years or didn't have enough staff members to warrant it if it's a growing business. So, yeah, a bit of a funny one. There's a couple of other weird ones we get at Christmas as well. Anyone on the state pension gets a Christmas bonus. But before you get too excited, if this is your first Christmas of getting the state pension, it is £10 you get. And that has not gone up since 1977.
Right. OK, I feel we've had a little bit of a Scrooge-like conversation here, Holly. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. A very Merry Christmas to you. Well, let's hear how Father Christmas feels about this. Very good afternoon to you, Santa Claus.
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas. Hello there.
I never know how I feel about meeting Santa. I mean, it just, I don't want to have...
Hopefully you feel joy.
Yes.
You feel joy, Dee.
Yes, I'm feeling something, that's for sure. Yeah. Now, Santa, we've come straight to the horse's mouth, I guess. I mean, does this allowance, this tax-free allowance freeze, mean anything to you? Does it mean that your seasonal work is being very badly paid because the Chancellor hasn't increased the allowance?
Well, do you know, I'm not so sure about that. I think as long as people are having Christmas parties, I think that's a good thing, isn't it? It kind of spreads Christmas cheer throughout the world, really.
Do you ever consider that the elves should be getting a bit more of a pay rise, though?
Oh, yes, yes, of course, of course. I'm all for elves getting paid well for their work. They work ever so hard, and it's a very difficult job to do, you see. So yes, I think they should increase as much as they can within reason, of course.
Are they well above the minimum wage?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think they are well above the minimum wage, but and so they could perhaps get a little bit more, you see.
Yes. Do they have to go to the Christmas office parties with you?
Oh, sometimes, yes, yes, of course, sometimes. It depends on what the company want, you see. Sometimes they would like an elf or two in attendance to help some of the children there. Or sometimes they just want Father Christmas, you see.
Yeah. What's the most lavish Father Christmas party you've been to?
Oh, do you know what? They all seem to be very, very, very well put on, and it's not about the lavishness of it all. It's all about just putting it on in the first place, you see. I don't really look into how lavish an event is, so long as it's on. I mean, that's the main thing.
That is the main thing, and of course, you're absolutely right. This is all about the spirit of Christmas. But I was rather hoping that you might feel like whistle blowing on some of the more extreme celebrations that you have undoubtedly seen throughout your time as Santa Claus.
It's not for me to whistleblow such, but I have to say, when I go to sort of, when there are no children at the event, the adults can get a little bit naughty.
Can they?
Yes.
Can you tell us any tales about that?
they like to sit on my knee and pull my beard and whiskers, you see. So, but then generally that's because a certain amount of alcohol has been involved.
Yes, you'd always stay sober, though, wouldn't you?
Oh, of course, yes. You never drink and fly, as they say.
Right. It's seasonal work. Is the rest of the year a little bit testing, or you're just on holiday for that time?
No, we're in the North Pole and we're making all the toys, you see. We've got lots of planning to do, so there's an awful lot to do, you see. It's not just Christmas where I get all the glory, you see. All the elves and everything make all the toys and organise everything, and I get all the glory at the end. But there's an awful lot to do, you see, during the year.
One of our listeners says that you sound like Boris Johnson.
Oh, dear, yes. Well, some people have said that. I assure you, I'm not Boris Johnson. I have, you know, I'm not as naughty as he can sometimes be. And of course, I have no children of my own.
No, and he would spend many Christmases just wrapping the presents for his own children, so he'd be busy. Thank you very much indeed, Santa Claus. Lovely to hear from you. All the best for the festive season, and I hope that your tax allowances remain plentiful.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Fee. Lovely to speak to you.
Lovely to talk to you.
Merry Christmas!
I would think Santa might be a little bit busy right now to be coming on Times Radio or going to lots and lots of parties.
No, I think Santa Claus always makes time for speech radio.
Okay,
it's
there we go.
Essential part of
just
Christmas.
Just for the ho-ho-ho,
yes,
really.
Just for the ho-ho-ho. That was Santa.
And there we go. I'm sorry if your budget has been a little bit cut or tighter for your Christmas party this year. Coming up here, why? This doesn't quite make sense to me. I think the last time I took a black cab was probably about 5 years ago. But maybe we're wrong about the demise of the black cab. More and more people are learning the knowledge. Why? We'll find out more after the news with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has described junior doctor strikes as dangerous and irresponsible. Resident doctors in England have begun their 5-day walkout, with the union insisting the government can and must go further on pay. However, ministers insist bigger pay rises are unaffordable. Dr. Aaron Ghosh, who practices in Liverpool, says doctors are losing public support and that of their more senior colleagues.
I think this is an awful timing, and I really don't think the public's going to be behind them. These junior doctors need to grow up, and the BMA absolutely need to take a long, hard look at themselves. Our first duty is to do no harm. I don't think any doctor going on strike today can genuinely say their action is going to do no harm.
Police in London and Manchester will start arresting people who chant "Globalise the Intifada" at pro-Palestinian marches. Police chiefs say the context has changed in light of anti-Semitic attacks like on Bondi Beach in Australia and at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. The Duke of Marlborough has been charged with 3 counts of non-fatal intentional strangulation. The relative of Sir Winston Churchill and Princess Diana was arrested in May. Sir Keir Starmer says the government is willing to take action in the courts to unlock £2.5 billion from the sale of Chelsea Football Club and send it to humanitarian causes in Ukraine. The government has granted a licence for that to happen, but the money is currently frozen amid deadlocked negotiations with the Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich. And in tennis, the men's number one, Carlos Alcaraz, has announced he's splitting up with his coach unexpectedly. Juan Carlos Ferrero has worked with the 22-year-old since he was a teenager, during which time he's won 24 titles, including 6 Grand Slams. Don't forget, you can set the time News Briefing as your new service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Water. It doesn't get nearly enough credit. You drink it, you grow your dinner with it, you wash your bits with it, you surf on it like some kind of levitating wizard. Yes, water is the greatest. Without it, Earth would be just another dry, crusty cosmic fail like Mars. Think about it. Everything you know and love starts with water. Your dog, your car, your internet, which is basically just a load of sweaty computers kept cool in a bath. And then there is just a small miracle of keeping us alive. Without drinking water, you wouldn't survive more than 3 days. Some mates take longer to text you back. So let's raise a glass to clean water. It's hard to imagine life without it. Seriously, how is it that 1 million people die every year because they lack access to clean water? That's not just unthinkable. That's wrong. Donate to WaterAid today. Just £2 a month can give life-changing clean water.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
Fee and Rosie with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon, then John Pienaar takes over. Hello, John.
Hi, Fee. Hello. So lots to talk about today. I mean, when isn't there? But we've got, I'm starting with the new General Secretary of the Unison Giant Trade Union, who is a known and proud hardliner. He's promising to hold the government's feet to the fire. She won the unison fight. And now she's going to be joining a lineup which includes the leader of the other giant union, Unite, Sharon Graham. And with difficult pay negotiations and demands coming up in these coming months, it doesn't look great for the government. I'm not sure it looked great anyway, whoever was in charge, but you've now got a really tough leader of Unison. And we think about this a lot now with doctors on strike. That starts today. And on that, interesting that employers' bodies, the Confederation and NHS providers are both saying go to arbitration. They're looking for a way to break the deadlock. So talking about that. And also, as it were, staying inside the health sphere, really interesting that the story is on the front of the Times that C-sections has overtaken natural births as the way women have their babies now, which is just an interesting trend.
John, it is. And when you dig into that story as well, the difference in the number of C-sections in different parts of the country amongst different demographics is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And it is true that there does seem to be a too posh to push thing going on, where in more affluent areas there are more C-sections. C-sections are not safer than other forms of birth, but I fully understand why, with so many stories about birth difficulties and birth trauma, an awful lot of women think that they are. It's I think it's such a sign of our times, actually.
So true. And so talking about that, and Donna Ockenden, who sort of wrote the book on
questions
of pregnancy and birth, she's going to be on the show too.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you. That's John Pienaar, and his programme starts at 4 o'clock and goes through until 7. I've given myself away there, haven't I? I'm very excited about hearing a bit more of that story. I do think it's massively important, actually, and not least because the birth rate is dropping in this country, and there definitely seems to be anecdotal evidence that women are becoming more and more fearful of having children, because some of the stories about our maternity services are so distressing in this country. And I think that's just a terrible shame. I'm not saying that every woman exists on the planet to have children, but to be scared in a first world country of what childbirth might do to you or your baby, it's just not a place that we should be in at all, not in 2025. So I hope that everyone can listen to that interview as well.
Absolutely. It's 2:37. Now, the knowledge is the test of every back route and London and location in London that every black cab driver must pass. It's 160 years old. But in the age of sat-nav, or now Waze or Google Maps, you think it would be going the way of the dodo. You'd be wrong. Applications are up almost 70% in the last 3 years. So what's going on? Andy Sylvester has been investigating. He's the Times London editor. Andy, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
How often would you get a black cab?
More often than I care to admit, okay. Especially during the Christmas party season.
Okay. And is that because you can't get an Uber?
It's because I think the pricing has started to equalise in some ways. And there is nothing quite like on a rainy night seeing that orange light of salvation, yes, when you're stood outside in the rain. So I think convenience is a reason people still use it. There is still a trust level around it getting you home faster than other options. They can use bus lanes. So if you're going far, you can get a move on. But nonetheless, as you say, they are a dying breed. They're down from 25,000 a few years ago to just 17,000 cabs on the road. But as you say, that might be changing.
So remind us the knowledge. I think when we hear of it, we just know it's this incredibly complex test, and actually so much so that when you have brain scans of people who've done the knowledge and those haven't, they've got, I think it's a bigger hippocampus because they actually alters their brain structure. It is a mighty test to undertake.
It is. So you need to know, and off the top of my head, it's 600 locations across the capital. This has been changed recently to make it slightly quote-unquote easier. But you need to know all these locations across the capital. You need to then be able to, in your mind and on a map and speaking out loud, go from those places to the other place on the cotton, as it's called, which is a straight line. So the closest you can to a straight line, because that is the easiest way to get there. It's the quickest way, and it costs the passenger the least, which is how you pass these things. And as you are qualifying, which used to take about 5 years, TfL have made it slightly easier. So now it's just the 3 years of hard graft and revision and driving the streets and cycling the streets and mopeding around the streets. You are tested on them, face-to-face examinations, gradually getting harder, gradually getting closer together, so you've got less time to revise. And then you get your badge and off you go and you set your own hours. And many of these black cab drivers that I've spoken to that have been qualifying recently started out in private hires. They started out in Ubers or Bolts or whatever the case may be. And because they are driving around town all the time anyway, they've started to develop the knowledge almost unknowingly, no pun intended, but find being a black cab driver is more rewarding. They get to set their own hours a little bit more. There's more freedom and there's more protection, I guess, just by being part of the bigger union of cabbies.
So you think that is what is behind that increase?
So I've spent some time at a place called Knowledge Point School, quite a bit of time, which is in Euston, where aspiring cabbies go and learn. And it's this incredible classroom of A to Z maps of London covered in laminate, of which you just mark your routes on and you test each other. And what struck me, I think, in London, which is a wonderfully diverse place with, you know, hundreds of nationalities, it's very rare to actually get a Somali guy sat next to a Colombian guy talking to each other and doing the same thing on the map. And this room was a collection of people with immigrant backgrounds or immigrants themselves predominantly, doing the knowledge together, testing themselves in this real communal way. And the one thing that they kept saying when we asked why they did it, it was freedom. It was the knowledge that the fares are always the same. You know, it's 20 quid from Buckingham Palace to the city any day of the week, rather than relying on a platform to set your fees. And you get the benefits of being self-employed, which is all a bit of a black area, a grey area, I should say, on private hire platforms. So I think freedom's the key thing. And I think they also believe that black cabs will never truly go out of fashion. There will still be people who want to jump in one at the Chelsea Flower Show to get to dinner. There will still be a queue of cabs outside the Royal Opera House of an evening. And
you've picked two very sort of affluent activities there. Do you really believe there is enough demand that in, let's say, 2 decades, because there was a report earlier this year that said, yep, that this really potentially is a dying breed. Do you think there's enough demand?
I do think the changes to the knowledge, which have made it easier to qualify, 3 years is shorter than 5 years. The fares are now being set at a slightly higher level, to be honest. So the money is better than it was previously. And there will be a point of plateau where the number of black cabs does continue to drop a little bit, but that means that the ones that are left will be busy. So I could see a world in which we don't have cabs in 50 years or 100 years, but I think even as those numbers fall, the demand will probably fall alongside, and there will still be more cabs occupied than there are with their orange lights on.
You said something very important at the beginning, Andy, about cabs being able to use bus lanes.
Yes.
Now, for people who are listening outside London, they may not appreciate just how much our roads in the capital are now carved up into domestic vehicles and the bus lane. So is it the case that no private hire vehicle can go in the bus lane? It's
that,
only buses
that
and
is
cabs?
Correct.
Okay.
Buses, cabs, bikes. And that obviously means moving around town is an awful lot quicker in a black cab than it would be stuck with the rest of the traffic in private hire. And TfL, to their credit, not only have they made the knowledge easier while still retaining the kind of prestige of the test, they are making efforts to make it easier for cabbies to get around town. It won't sound like that necessarily when you talk to a cabbie who bemoans the arrival of a low traffic neighbourhood. But, you know, things like London Bridge, you can now cross that during the day as a cabbie. You didn't used to be able to do that 2 years ago when they just shut it off for all traffic. So, and round through Bank Junction as well. I'm getting properly into the weeds of London geography. But it is now easier to drive around as a cabbie than it was a couple of years ago. And they are gently appreciative of that, even if they don't tell you.
You mentioned the price. They are becoming more competitive with what you'd be getting on your phone, Lyft or Uber. And in the most recent budget, the cost of getting those ride app cabs is going up, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And those platforms are going to have to take on more costs as well, because a lot of them tend to be... They will be exempted from the changes to electric vehicle charging, but they have other costs that they will have to absorb. So yes, it will equalise. And I think that's one of the reasons that people are taking these tests, is there is a more reliable sense of income. If you're a black cab and you go out on the last Thursday night before Christmas, you are going to be busy.
Yeah.
And you know you're going to be busy. And you do also have the ability to say no to fares. You have that ability on private hire, but if you do that too often on private hire, you start to get fewer fares come through. So it is a freedom thing. Many people, unfortunately, will not take a black cab just in case they have to have a conversation. But I urge you to speak to your black cab driver. They're full of pearls of wisdom.
It sounds like the ones you've been speaking to are. Do you chat in the cab?
No, I don't take black cabs very often, actually. I don't take private hire very often. I have been a cyclist around London for many, many years until recently. I slightly mourn the demise of the black cab, actually. And it's interesting when you noted the Chelsea Flower Show and the Royal Opera House as pickup points. Sometimes I'll get a cab from a station. The idea now, just when I'm wandering around London, that I'd still be able to stick my hand out and three cabs would fly towards it. I think that might be the reason why I simply don't really take cabs. I don't factor it in as a very easy form of transport in London anymore, actually, Andy.
No, that's true. They are experimenting, of course, with being on the apps. You can now get a black cab on Uber if the driver wants to be on that platform. You can now get a black cab on their own version of, I think it's called Free Now, I forget whatever it is called. I won't give them free advertising. Again, there are more innovative ways to call these things, and I think they're trying to adapt with the times. But it is City of London, people getting around town, and it is those big events. Those are still the things that black cabs will continue to thrive on
and
the back of.
It's a glorious thing, isn't it? I don't know what age you first came to London. Actually, you're born and bred London, aren't you? We have found this out in an interview you'll be able to hear on the podcast, actually.
Indeed.
In weeks to come. You're a born and bred Londoner.
Absolutely.
As well. Okay, I'm on my own here. When I first came to London, the sensation of getting into a London cab, nothing will ever replace that as a memory. It just made you feel so glamorous, so independent. The idea that you could stand, you know, in the middle of the street and wave your hand and a cab would come along.
I still feel that now.
It
would
feel
very luxurious and experienced to say, oh, I'll take a black cab.
Yeah, but it was just so, you know, a little part of my life was made in those early cab journeys. So we should never, ever take them for granted.
I should mention as well, public transport in London's going up quite significantly next year as well.
Cost-wise, yeah, no, absolutely. TfL fares are going to go up far higher than they will in the rest of the country because of the funding settlement deal that Sadiq Khan struck with the government.
There we go. It's going to be expensive to commute anyway, unless
exactly.
You're on your bike. Andy, thank you. Andy Sylvester, The Times London editor, on the fact that more people are choosing to take the knowledge.
This one in from Sarah. We recently took a black cab from Clapham Junction to Paddington as we had too much luggage to go on public transport. Uber quoted £25, but we chose a black cab because they can travel in the bus lanes. It was a non-stop journey through a Christmassy London and a magical Hyde Park. We saw the £30 fare as a wonderful sightseeing trip. How fabulous. Happy Christmas to you. Coming up, your top telly for the weekend and more with Scott Bryan. You are listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Co-op members now get prices matched to Aldi. Hold on, no way. Okay then, so co-op members now get everyday essentials price matched to Aldi. Sign up and start saving. Co-op, owned by you, right by you.
I wasn't expecting that.
Co-op member prices matched versus comparable selected products at Aldi GB. Co-op membership required. Co-op group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk/Aldi price match.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It is 12 minutes to 3. Warner Brothers has advised its shareholders to reject Paramount's £81 billion hostile bid, clearing the way for Netflix to swoop in. Scott Bryan, TV critic to the stars and to us, is here to help us make sense of that one. Hello, Scott.
Hello, afternoon.
Tell us a bit more about this. How did we get to this point and how significant is all of this?
So I feel that if I try to explain it in detail, we will pretty much hit the 3 o'clock news. So I'll try to be quite swift. But essentially, it comes down to the fact that Warner Brothers, which is part of a larger company, Warner Brothers Discovery, been spun off into its own independent company, has been swooped in not by one, but by two companies. One is sort of owned by Skydance, which currently owns CBS. Paramount essentially sort of could build quite a big company under David Ellison. And the other one, which is sort of quite high profile and certainly created a bit of a buzz throughout Hollywood, has been Netflix. Netflix actually came in first with a bid of around, you know, classically around 70 billion, you know, small bits of change, really. And the interesting one about Netflix is, of course, Netflix were the innovators. They were the ones who came in first to revolutionise the way that we watch TV, but has been creating a lot of fear within the Hollywood industry just because they are quite diametrically opposed to how films used to be in terms of very much based around cinema releases. Netflix have said, well, at least Ted Sarandos, who is the co-CEO, has been clear that he wants with their ownership of Warner's for the company to be more sort of commercially friendly, in his words, to consumers, which is certainly feared cinema owners, because normally how it would be films would be in cinemas for, you know, 60, 70 days. Then there would be a gap before they're available to watch for people at home, whilst Netflix really tend to only have a very short release period, no, maybe only a few weeks before they're available to be at home, because they're much more geared towards membership of people watching on the home. So I think essentially they're able to fend off this much larger bid, then Netflix can then proceed. I don't think this is the end of this story. And also there's going to be major hoops around regulatory issues around whether this would create too much of a monopoly or have too much of a market share, issues throughout Europe as well. I mean, I think if Netflix or Skydance get it, you know, we are going to be, I would say, 18 months, 2 years before we have an overall final winner.
Right, so we'll talk again on that one, Scott.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
prepare yourselves, everybody. Some people, just back to, you know, normal bums on sofas TV watching, Scott, some people are finding the schedule a bit lacking at the moment. I mean, it always is at this time of year, isn't it? Because all of the big autumnal series have concluded and no scheduler's going to waste a decent thing in the couple of weeks before Christmas holidays, are they?
You're exactly right. I mean, there's always been this window. I mean, November tends to be when the big TV series debut, sometimes a bit earlier in September. Of course, November was absolutely huge with the Celebrity Traitors as well. And I think what always happens now is that you get a lot of Christmas preparation series. So think of like the likes of Kirsty and Phil or Jamie Oliver, for example, filling in this time of year. And then, of course, come the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, that's when the channels, the broadcasters really start to up the ante. But I mean, I'll be honest and say this year's TV is really quite underwhelming in terms of Christmas. I mean, it does come through when you look through the schedules on Christmas Day, for example. There's the spin-off of Motherland, Amandaland, which has been a big comedy hit this year. That's got a delightful Christmas Day episode. But, you know, the other outings, you've got to Call the Midwife again, of course, very popular show, but hardly going to be, you know, surprising sort of viewers as something being really like attention grabbing. Same with Michael McIntyre's The Wheel. I mean, nothing, people that will get, shows that will get bums on seats, but not really creating anywhere near as much of an event of last year, which of course were the Wallace and Gromit special, plus also the Gavin and Stacey special. Both events got more than 20 million and ended up being not only some of the most watched Christmas Day TV in modern eras, but also some of the most watched TV so far this century, if you exclude news and sport. Yeah. So a tough act to follow.
Well, very much so, Scott, but it just seems really extraordinary that given that success last year, the channels didn't seek to recreate it. Because you're absolutely right, there's just nowt on.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I completely agree with you. When I first got the Radio Times, which I've actually got next to me, because, of course, I can't not have it beside me throughout this entire month, and I was scrolling through the different channels, so ITV, Channel 4, BBC, my reaction was a bit like, really? Is that it? And I am a bit surprised, because I do think it is a missed opportunity. I mean, I do think viewership is changing, of course. I think Christmas Day is not as important as it used to. And I think maybe the BBC's logic is put more resources into New Year's Day. You know, that's where we've got The Night Manager, the long-awaited follow-up. Starring Tom Hiddleston. You've also got the Return of the Traitors back for a fourth series not long after the Celebrity one. Both of those will be absolutely big rating smashes, I would reckon, at least initially.
Yeah.
But yeah, a missed opportunity Christmas. I think it really has been a bit of an underwhelming event, really.
I tell you what we've been doing over the last week or so, Scott, is rewatching the initial series of The Night Manager in preparation for series two. And because it was so blooming long ago, I thought I can't possibly watch this again and be intrigued by it, but we absolutely were. It is so worth your time. Just the luxurious, sumptuous nature of the locations, everything about it is just, just 5.5 stars, isn't it? It's glorious stuff. I want to go on.
No, so I completely agree. I mean, it came at a time when I think premium TV like this, like movie style quality to TV, was really starting to come through. But I completely agree. I'm actually going to rewatch it before the New Year's Day second series, which is interesting because series two will go beyond, of course, the original source material, because series one covers all of the book by John le Carré. So I think it will be interesting to see where they go from there. But trust me, the only thing I can remember from series one is that it has in one sequence a very, very heavily pregnant Olivia Colman with a gun. And that's it. You'll have to rewatch it.
I remember that, actually. Scott, you know, there's a question I've always wanted to ask you, because you watch a lot of TV, the good and really the quite awful. We talk about screen time a lot. How much TV time do you think you have on an average day, or at least an average week?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I mean, this is the thing. I'm in the weird and quite kind of grateful position where I get to watch a lot of TV during the day because I'm not in meetings, of course, because I just watch it as part of my job as a means of prep. So I would say maybe like 20 or 30 hours a week, which sounds like a lot, but actually I think a lot of people just do it during the evening. During the evening, I do something else. So, yeah.
Not bad. Not as bad as I thought it was going to be there. Can I take our listeners to a completely different genre to discuss the Great Bed and Breakfast Challenge on Channel 4, which has been stripped across their daytime schedule at 5 o'clock for the last month, Scott? Have you watched this at all? And if so, have you enjoyed it at all?
I've only seen a bit because I was told by your fantastic producer about it. I mean, I can see, like, these sort of B&B shows have been a mainstay of TV for quite a long time. I think, like, what I admire, because I sort of got stuck into, was it A Four in a Bed, which is basically people making incredibly passive-aggressive comments about each other's B&B. Like, once somebody was having a complaint about the fact that the sun didn't come through their windows, the sunshine didn't come through their windows, and I was like, well, they didn't build the house that the B&B's in, so they can't really, you know, change the position of the sun, but that's just a small gripe about this. What is it about this show that you particularly like?
I think the fact that they win the bed and breakfast. So the whole shtick is that couples are competing to win a bed and breakfast in France. So that's been bought by Channel 4 for them. And when they started out, they were doing kind of practice sessions in these glorious bed and breakfasts in the Dordogne with swimming pools. They looked like mini chateaus. You just thought, God, that absolutely is a life-changing prize to win. Ultimately, they've all found themselves in a slightly smaller kind of hotel de village somewhere in slightly more northern France without a swimming pool. That was the building that they were going to win. But it was still substantial enough to be involved with the contestants' emotions about it. I think that's what I liked. And the contestants are just hilarious.
I just like that this is also, with great affection, very much a reflection of every Channel 4 daytime show at once.
Yes,
like, if they're not doing a B&B show, they are restoring an abandoned village or a chateau in the south of France. So why not converge the two and make it into one?
You know? You're absolutely spot on. It's like a bouillabaisse of daytime television, Scott. Everything has been chucked into that pan.
All we need is it to be set in Yorkshire and have a canal boat.
Well,
and then we're settled. Then we're done.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, Scott, because lots of our listeners to the podcast have written in, because they've been enjoying watching it too, to point out the fact that it's very unlikely a British couple could go to France to run a B&B at the moment, because after Brexit you're not entitled to do exactly that kind of thing. So I think season two is bound to be in Yorkshire. It may well be on a barge. Scott, it's always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. This will be the last time that I speak to you before Christmas, so I wish you a very, very Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
I'll think of you when I'm watching Amanda Leonard.
Oh, thank you very much. Same to you. Merry Christmas.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. In the next hour, concerns around a series of scandals under the watch of the new Archbishop of Canterbury have put her appointment into question. We'll speak to the Times Radio presenter, Kathy Newman. George Osborne has been hired by OpenAI to spread democratic artificial intelligence across the world. We'll hear from our resident tech journalist, Chris Stoker-Walker. And our big interview after 3:30 is with Andrew Billen, Times journalist and interviewer, about what really goes on behind the scenes before one of those big interviews. First, though, let's get the very latest news with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Keir Starmer has called resident doctor strikes in England dangerous and utterly irresponsible. He was asked about the walkout, which started this morning at Prime Minister's Questions, and insists his government's approach is an improvement on the last.
They left the NHS absolutely on its knees, waiting lists through the roof, and confidence absolutely rock bottom. And Mr. Speaker, I take no lectures for them on industrial harmony. More days were lost to strike action on their wealth than any year since the 1980s.
However, the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the new strikes are a result of the above-inflation pay rise given to doctors soon after Labour won the last election. She called on the government to make doctor strikes illegal.
Mr Speaker, of course he's not going to ban doctor strikes. He doesn't have the baubles. The trade unions didn't just buy him... They can shake their heads all they like. We all know who's running their party, and it's not him. The trade unions didn't just buy him for Christmas, they bought him for life.
The British Medical Association says the government can and must offer a bigger pay rise. The strike will go on until Monday morning. Police in London and Manchester will arrest people who chant "Globalise the Intifada" at pro-Palestinian marches. Some campaigners have argued the phrase is a call to violence against Jewish people, but the police say it has not met prosecuting thresholds before. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, says that has changed in light of anti-Semitic attacks like at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester and on Bondi Beach in Sydney.
We will be using our powers to arrest for people for reasonable suspicion of committing offences. Where the threat context has changed, that means the impact of some phrases that haven't been prosecuted in the past we think have greater impact today. They have greater impact on communities when we see escalating threats and more terrorist attacks. That's why we're going to be more assertive.
The human rights regulator says it will closely monitor how forces enforce the decision. Labour will pave the way for large council tax hikes in wealthier councils in the south by scrapping the need for locals to approve the move in a referendum. New funding settlements for councils will seek to rebalance funding to poorer northern areas. Kensington and Chelsea, Hammersmith and Fulham, Wandsworth, Westminster, Windsor and Maidenhead and the City of London are the councils which will be explicitly exempt from having a referendum. Keir Starmer's control over Labour has been significantly weakened after one of his key backers was ousted by a left-wing critic. Grassroots activist Andrea Egan has promised to review Unison's relationship with the party after beating the incumbent General Secretary, Christina McAneer. Warner Brothers Discovery has told shareholders to reject a hostile takeover bid from rival Paramount Skydance. Bosses at Warner Brothers say the proposed deal from Paramount is inferior to the one that they've already agreed with Netflix. And at the Ashes, the company behind Australia's video review system says operator error was why an Australian batsman wasn't given out when he should have been in the crucial third test. Alex Carey was allowed to carry on despite being caught by England because the video and sound replay on Snicko was out of sync. Australia were 245 for 6 at the time, but they finished day one on 326 for 8. England have to win the third test if they're going to keep the series alive. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past three. It's Rosie Wright and Fee Glover here with you until four. We're going to have some fun after 3:30 in the company of Andrew Billen. He's going to talk us through some of the interviews that he has done this year. He is also the go-to man when anybody famous dies, because inevitably, at some point in his 40-year career, if it's a cultural institution, somebody who's contributed something to society, Andrew Billen will have profiled or interviewed them. So there's nothing he doesn't know, really, about the great and the good. And that's what we'll do after 3:30, is interview the interviewer. We've got all of the tech news as well with Chris Stokel-Walker in this half an hour of the programme. And we love your thoughts. Anything we're talking about, we're 0333 003 2353. Now, the naming of Sarah Mullally as the Archbishop of Canterbury was supposed to herald a new beginning for the Church of England after the resignation of Justin Welby. But now there are calls for her appointment to be stopped. A member of the General Synod says there should be an investigation into concerns about her handling of past safeguarding cases. Fresh details have emerged in a Channel 4 investigation, and Cathy Newman, Times Radio and Channel 4 presenter, joins us now. Cathy, good afternoon.
Hi there.
You are the journalist who knows more than anybody about all of these things. So I wonder whether you can tell us a bit about the background to all of this.
Yes, we've been investigating what happened under Sarah Mullally's watch. She's Bishop of London. A terrible tragedy that occurred in 2020 when Father Alan Griffin, a priest in the London diocese, took took his own life. And the circumstances that led up to that are really very murky and very disturbing, because he took his own life after learning that a load of lies about him, terrible lies, were circulating about his private life. And that was contained in a secret dossier that had been drawn up by a former head of operations in the London Diocese. Now, the key question is what Sarah Mullally did with this dossier. Now, what we reported last night, we had a secretly recorded conversation that someone who was in that dossier, there were 42 clergy members named in that dossier. It was a mixture of lies, gossip, and also genuine safeguarding concerns. Someone named in that dossier challenged her in a phone call, which they secretly recorded. And in response to that challenge, she says she didn't read the dossier because she thought it was gossip. Now, Reverend Robert Thompson, who is a London priest, but he's also a member of the General Synod, told us on our programme last night that actually, if Sarah Mullally did read the dossier and failed to act on it, that's a problem. But if she didn't read the dossier, that is also a failure in her duties as bishop. And he says she's got blood on her hands, and the appointment promotion of her to the Archbishop of Canterbury needs to be halted until this is investigated. Well, the Bishop of London herself told us that she didn't read the report because its contents needed to be, and I quote, properly assessed by safeguarding professionals and the diocesan registrar. But she did confirm that she was told who was named in the report. And she also said that since becoming Bishop of London in 2018 and before, she's spoken publicly about the clear need for independent scrutiny of safeguarding across the Church of England. She commissioned an independent review into the circumstances leading up to Father Allen's death to examine exactly what went wrong. And the public recommendations from that report, the Robson report, she said had been vital ever since in driving forward change across the Diocese of London.
We've got a little bit of a clip, actually, from exactly what you're talking about, what you revealed on Channel 4 last night. I wonder whether we can just hear this and then a couple more questions, please.
You know, when the safeguarding team sought out what was gossip and what wasn't gossip, I never went back and read that report, because why would I want to know what gossip was?
OK, so this is exactly what you were talking about there, Cathy. This place that Sarah Mullally has put herself in as to whether or not she read the report or didn't read the report, either which suggests that her subsequent actions have failed the victim and families of victims. That's the gist of it, isn't it?
And the point is that the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, quit over a failure to act on safeguarding issues. Now Sarah Mullally is being accused of a failure to act on concerns. And if she had acted, friends of Father Alan Griffin say that he might have been prevented from taking his own life. So it really is, these are serious allegations.
So what do the victims' families, friends of the victims, and actually in a wider context, other victims themselves, want from the church right now?
Well, you know, they want independent safeguarding. The friends of Alan Griffin are calling for an independent review into all of these actions. That's something supported by the clergy. But we've got some new allegations that we're reporting on Channel 4 News tonight that concern a whistleblower who came into the safeguarding team in the Diocese of London after Father Alan's death. And she was supposed to help carry out some of these reforms that have been recommended by the coroner and this independent review into what went wrong. She tells us tonight on Channel 4 News that what she found in that safeguarding team horrified her. She made complaints. For example, she was advocating for another member of clergy who was being stalked and harassed. She says she was instructed by the head of safeguarding that the member of clergy could, and I quote, report crimes himself. Now, she says the church put him at risk, and she was worried that there would be other suicides among clergy. Now, she says after she raised those concerns, she was herself targeted, victimised and isolated. It all got so stressful that she attempted to take her own life, she says. And she was then subsequently forced out of her job and told to sign a confidentiality agreement, which she is breaking to speak to us tonight. Now, I must say, I put all of these allegations to the London Diocese. They said that Michelle Burns, the whistleblower, left by mutual consent, and that the confidentiality agreement that she was made to sign was a standard form. They also said that Michelle Burns had not made any disclosures to them about her concerns to the diocese under its whistleblowing policy. But they say that in the instance that she describes, the nature of her role would not necessarily have made her aware of how that clergy person she was worried about was being supported.
Wow. Who makes up the safeguarding teams, Cathy? Who's in that team?
Well, I've actually just been speaking to the bishop who's in charge of safeguarding, Joanne Grenfell, putting to her some of these concerns, which you'll hear again in that interview on Channel 4 News tonight. But I mean, she accepts that something terrible went wrong in the run-up to Alan Griffin's death. She is adamant that changes are being made. And you know, indeed, in her statement to us later on in that statement, the Bishop of London said, look, I understand there's going to be scrutiny of past cases as I prepare to take up this role of Archbishop of Canterbury. She welcomes light being shone on the past. But the problem that many of her own clergy in London say is that she says this, but actually when you look at what she has done and the safeguarding failures that she's been accused of presiding over, her actions don't bear out her words there. So this is going to be poured over in the next few weeks. There is this other allegation from a survivor who complained about her. That complaint wasn't properly dealt with. The diocese accepts that. So there is an outstanding complaint from Survivor N, as he's called, about how she handled abuse allegations against him within the church. That the general consensus is that bishops promoted don't take up those roles until all outstanding complaints are resolved. So what's going on behind the scenes now is that the church is trying to resolve those complaints against Sarah Mullally so she can be confirmed as archbishop within weeks and then enthroned in March. Now, there are those that think she's not going to get to that point, and she insists she will.
If she doesn't, though, who would become Archbishop of Canterbury? And from what you're telling us there, Cathy, I think we would be entitled to believe that scrutiny would really have to be put upon every single candidate in terms of how they have looked at safeguarding reports, whether they've read them or not read them, or all of those kind of things. And even when they then say the right thing, which is exactly what's happened here with Sarah Mullally, we are left with a rightful cynicism, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the lead bishop for safeguarding insists that during the appointment process, the committee in charge of selecting this archbishop, all done behind closed doors in great secrecy, Bishop Joanne Grenfell insists that all the proper checks were made, no concerns, as far as she is aware, were raised. Well, there's a lot of cynicism about that you've just alluded to, because when Bishop Sarah Mullally was announced as the new Archbishop of Canterbury, many people within the church were extremely excited that there was a first female archbishop, of course, wanted to celebrate that appointment, but also really surprised given that they knew how many concerns about safeguarding there had been in the London diocese. So a lot of people imagined that she would be ruled out because of those concerns. So in terms of who else would do it, if she was, I mean, I think the church will go to great lengths to ensure that she does get confirmed as archbishop in a few weeks' time and she does get to her enthronement in March, because the truth is that if they lose a second archbishop, that is really very serious for this institution that has survived for hundreds of years and is currently going through a bit of a crisis.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. That's Cathy Newman, and you can find out more in Channel 4 News on the Channel 4, 7 o'clock tonight.
And for many parts of the Church of England, it's not even a straightforward selection of having a female Archbishop of Canterbury, something that was much celebrated at the time. There are many parts of the church that would say, actually, and they have a specific management structure in the body of the Church of England that you could answer to someone else, because you wouldn't like to answer to a woman in sort of spiritual authority of a man. There are many multi-layered complex problems already at play in the Church of England, and potentially more, as Cathy's laid out.
Can I just also add that Cathy Newman is obviously here on Times Radio on Friday evenings from 4 till 7.
Coming up here, what does George Osborne know about AI? It's 3:15. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
We'll assess the first day of the resident doctors' strikes. It kicks in at the height of the flu season, of course. We'll also hear from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. He's speaking to the Commons Health Committee. Keir Starmer faces Kemi Badenoch in the last PMQs of the year. We'll look at that with the big political brain of Adam Bolton. And we'll talk through the biggest stories of the day with economist Yasmin Alibi-Brown and the Conservative commentator Albie Amankona.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Welcome to the Co-op Meal Deal Generator. To generate today's deal, say, give me something tasty. Here we go. It's a chicken and bacon sandwich, scotch egg, and a bottle of Lucozade. Only £3.75 for Co-op members. Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
Non-members £4.10 subject to availability. Prices may vary. Co-op Group Food Stores only £1 joining fee.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
It's 16 minutes past three. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright with you today. Now, one of our listeners has just asked, is Jane okay? Has she left? No, she hasn't, but she's got some pretty important family business going on at the moment. So she is needed in Crosby, which is where she is, and she will be back after Christmas and hopefully all will be well. But thank you for your concern. And no, she's not gone. She's not gone. She'll be back.
Now, it is 17 minutes past three. The former Chancellor, George Osborne, has been hired by OpenAI, they of course run ChatGPT, to head up their global Stargate initiative. Chris Stokel-Walker is our resident tech journalist, joins us now. Chris, I think it'd be helpful to start with telling us what the global Stargate initiative actually is.
Yeah, afternoon, Rosie. Yeah, so I mean, the Global Stargate Initiative is OpenAI's billboard policy to try and find its way into all of our lives all around the world. So we might remember, if we cast our minds back several months, Donald Trump in the White House unveiling the US Stargate Initiative, which was a data center, sort of $500 million worth of investment. In fact, sorry, $500 trillion, getting my billions and trillions mixed up there, of investment into the computer hardware that will allow AI to be served in the United States. And since then, OpenAI has been putting these Stargate data centers into different parts of the world, and alongside that, been offering this tool, which is OpenAI or ChatGPT for countries, which is the ability to get a cut price version of ChatGPT that is tailored towards governments in the hope that they will start to use this, rolling out their policies and building up quite a big customer base as well for OpenAI.
What we are hearing is they're saying they've hired George Osborne to lead the startup's work building democratic artificial intelligence for the world. What does that mean?
That effectively means not China, and it's just because they don't want to say not China. So there is this tussle at the minute between two superpowers in the AI race. We have the United States, which is backed by Donald Trump and an awful lot of money, and is where many of the big players that we're talking about, including OpenAI, are based. But then we saw the impact that the release of DeepSeek, the Chinese large language model, the AI tool that was a little bit like ChatGPT, had earlier this year in terms of upending the stock markets. And so really, OpenAI is presenting this as a race between two different superpowers, and governments worldwide have to pick which one they want to back. So they go either for what is being presented as the Western democratic capitalist ideal of the US version of this sort of thing, which they say is going to be OpenAI, but could also be Google and a couple of other competitors, or you choose to throw your lot in with China, and therefore you have everything that comes with that as well.
Yeah, George Osborne was very keen to sort of bang the drum for OpenAI in this announcement of his job position. I think you can understand why he wants to do that. He described OpenAI as the most exciting and promising company around right now. Do you share that sentiment?
Certainly they are leading the race at the minute, although it is a two-horse race in the United States between them and Google. And one of the interesting things that we're seeing lately is effectively OpenAI is being challenged quite significantly by Google. ChatGPT obviously changed the world when it was released in November 2022. There's a reason why we talk about AI in some way, shape or form pretty much every week on this tech slot. But really what's happened over the last few months, particularly with the release of the latest versions of these AI tools, ChatGPT 5.2, which was released earlier this week, a very small iteration on what has gone before, versus Google Gemini 3, which was a slightly larger leap, which came last month. I talked a little bit more about this on a video, by the way, for the Times Radio Tech YouTube channel, if people want to watch that just this week. But basically, OpenAI, I think, is being challenged somewhat by Google, which has this benefit of being an incumbent, being a giant company, and having, frankly, name recognition for all of us who use either Google for search or they use Gmail to try and do this stuff. So it makes a little bit of sense why George Osborne is being hired. Of course, worth pointing out, Rosie, George Osborne being hired in a new job is not necessarily news.
No.
This is something that has happened quite a lot over the last decade or so. But I think what is an indication here of quite so significant a move that it is it's one of many former politicians moving into the tech world. So obviously we had Nick Clegg, you've interviewed him on the programme in recent months, and also Rishi Sunak earlier this year took a role as an advisor with Anthropic, another AI company, and Microsoft. So I think what we're starting to see is these tech companies getting closer to governments, recognising that they have similar powers to governments and shared interests to governments, and so they're also realising to do that, they need to hire the people that used to be in government.
Yeah, you mentioned George Osborne's career. Right now, he's chairman of the British Museum, co-presenter of the Political Currency Broadcaster, a lecturer at Stanford University, an advisor to a cryptocurrency exchange, Coinbase. He's busy, so he'll be doing this as well now. One important thing that we are hearing from the UK government, they are insisting that tech deal negotiations between us, the UK, and the US are still happening. Remind us what the deal was supposed to be.
Yeah, this technology prosperity deal that was announced earlier this year when Donald Trump visited the UK on his second historic state visit was seen as,
carry on, Chris.
It was seen as a massive fillip for both countries to try and show some indication of where the future direction of travel was going. The problem, of course, with anything that you do with Donald Trump is that an agreement is not necessarily an agreement. So what had been a firm idea to kind of agree on where we're going to go in terms of technology that the Downing Street had been touting is really a significant moment for the UK. Turns out that maybe not the case. So the US looks like it's getting cold feet. In part, this is, I think, a little bit of a negotiating tactic around the broader trade deal that is going on between the UK and the US, and an unhappiness about the way in which we sometimes regulate tech and other organisations and other sectors. And so really I think this is a little bit of hokey-cokey where the US is saying, well, we don't want to be part of this deal at the minute. The UK is insisting that negotiations are still ongoing and that there is the special relationship. But the truth is that it shows that we are very much reliant on these US tech companies for all of our technology, and really we want to try and get away from that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. There is a story, this headline will make some people feel very nervous. Get ready for this. Hackers steal 200 million personal records of Pornhub users. So there are, well, tell us what happened first, because I think people will be nervous of extortion or blackmail as a result of this hack.
Yeah, well, first of all, if you are signing up to a porn website with your real name and your first real email, then I would suggest that you strongly reconsider your options in the future, because this
maybe let's not give advice about that.
Quite exactly. Yeah, but you know, if people are a little bit worried about that, maybe they are feeling a little bit hot under the collar at the minute, a little bit nervous, then perhaps that is a bit of advice that we can take for going forward.
But in what's changed, the background to this is because the law changed, the Online Safety Act, you do now need to provide details to access these websites, including in some cases proof of age. So it might be credit card details or your passport.
Yeah, you do, which is where, and we've talked previously about this, one of the key workarounds for this is simply downloading a VPN. And we've seen simultaneous to, I think, record-breaking levels of decreased interest in visiting adult websites. I think something like a 77% drop in the first month and a bit since the Online Safety Act was put in place. We also saw a massive uptick in VPN usage, which I think is a way of getting around that. So you simply route your internet traffic through a country where you don't need to give over your ID to do this. But in terms of what happened here, Rosie, it's still very much uncertain. So 200 million bits of information have appeared on the dark web as a result of a hack, but where that actually happened is where we start to see diverging stories. So Pornhub says, not us, Gov, this absolutely was not our problem. They say that this was a third-party provider called Mixpanel, who they used to work with. They provided basically data analytics showing who came to their website and why. And they had been allegedly hacked. Mixpanel, for their part, say that they don't think that was the case. They believe that the data came from a Pornhub employee who exfiltrated that data in 2023, and it's appeared now on these illicit dark web marketplaces. For everyday users, I think the problem is that this can be used to try and extort you. We've talked in the past about some of the risks of not just ransomware, but the pressure that you can feel from hackers to try and disclose information or to hand over money so that compromising images or information are not released publicly about you. You know, the one thing I think that has been said and agreed on here is no passwords or payment details have been released, so it's not as if you're suddenly going to see lots of strange transactions. If you are one of those 200 million people caught up in this appearing on your credit card statements, instead, perhaps just a little bit of embarrassment as hackers say, well, we know what you do in your spare time and we might share that with your family.
Because they've got your viewing habits, email address, activity type. I mean, for some people might think that's worse than having your payment details. It's not the first time we've had websites like this hacked. I remember Ashley Madison, that was a sort of extramarital affairs website. They were hacked, weren't they?
They were. This happens all the time, unfortunately, and particularly as the online worlds and the online world start to blend and people get romance involved in their digital lives, this becomes increasingly challenging. So, yeah, the policy, I think, would always be very wary of what you do. Make sure that you're segregating your password so that if one instance of this sort of thing is hacked, then it doesn't give the hackers the keys to the kingdom, and just be very, very careful with what you share online.
You mentioned the VPN sidetrack around the online safety rules. It seems to be such a major loophole that actually, you know, a tech-savvy teenager who, you know, these laws were designed to make sure they weren't accessing, you know, harmful content online could bypass. Is there any indication that they're going to sort of tighten up the rules of who can access these websites so there isn't sort of a very easy get-around?
Yeah, well, we've seen the government here in the UK talking about the fact that they absolutely won't be taking action to try and ban outright VPNs. But in the past, they have said that they are potentially minded to think about blocking the advertising of those tools to everyday users, which would mean that, you know, it becomes more difficult for you to find out information about them, to realise that they exist, and then to actually utilise them. But you know, the challenge really that we have is you can always find a way around something. There has been reporting just this week that Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, is starting to instigate at the behest of the European Union, who is very worried about underage users accessing their services completely innocuously. So slightly different to the Online Safety Act, I admit, Rosie, but still important, starting to integrate across all of their systems in the months to come, particularly in 2026, a more robust age verification system, which looks more at the makeup of your face, doesn't necessarily need ID, and allows to try and guarantee an age within a relative bound of sort of limitations to guess properly how old you might be. But even then, those things aren't, you know, impossible to get around. And that's the big challenge that we have, is you can never really guarantee how old someone is online.
Thank you so much for your time, Chris Stokel-Walker, the tech journalist.
Now, coming up after 3:30, we're going to turn the tables on the interviewer, Andrew Billen. Every week on this programme, you hear fantastic interviews with brilliant guests after 3:30. If you miss them, fear not, because you can listen to them all again on 2,334 episodes of Off Air with Jane and Fee. Only some exaggeration there. Last week, we spoke to Paul Feig, director of films like Bridesmaids, Ghostbusters and Spy. It's not the easiest time to be a liberal filmmaker in the States. And I asked Paul how he thinks that those filmmakers will look back at this period in time.
transitionary, I would dare say. But again, you know, theater's kind of got in trouble during COVID, and it's taken a while to come back, but it's coming back. I mean, if you look at the box office reports recently, things are, you know, people are coming back to theaters, but they're more discerning because it's really expensive to go to the movies. And I do think the studios should probably figure out a way to drop the prices a bit because, you know, I was just talking to when we did a premiere in New York, and one of the workers at the theater was saying, yeah, I took my kids to see Zootopia 2 and it was like $100 for, you know, and it's, that's the problem, you know, so that's one of the problems. On top of just making sure that we're putting stuff in the theaters where you go like, okay, it's worth it to get out of my house and pack up the car and go and pay money.
Well, that's the director, Paul Feig, and his latest movie is The Housemaid. It's out on Boxing Day in the UK. It's getting 4 and 5 stars all round. If you like those suspenseful, twisty, turny thrillers with some property porn in the background,
it's
definitely...
And a bit of gore.
And a bit of gore. Yes, quite a bit of gore, actually. You'll never look at a kitchen knife in the same way again. Actually, you'll never look at a dentist in the same way again. It does get a hard recommend from me, though. It's a great, great movie. Coming up, the Times feature writer Andrew Billen. We're going to talk to him about the people he's met this year and also some of the people we've lost this year. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Starmer has called resident doctor strikes in England utterly irresponsible and dangerous. A 5-day walkout began this morning after members of the British Medical Association rejected a government offer on jobs. The union says ministers must do more on pay. Dr Shivam Sharma from the BMA is on the picket line outside St Thomas's Hospital in London.
These strikes are to improve patient care. You know, the public must have seen that they're waiting over 12 hours in A&E in corridors. That is not dignified. They're waiting over years, 2 years, for even appointments, such as in my specialty, child and adolescent psychiatry. And that's because we don't have the doctors. And the doctors that we do have are leaving.
The health secretary says a bigger pay offer would be unaffordable. Police in London and Manchester will start arresting people who chant "Globalise the Intifada" at pro-Palestinian marches. Police chiefs say the context has changed in light of anti-Semitic attacks like on Bondi Beach over the weekend. Sir Keir Starmer says the government is willing to take legal action to unlock £2.5 billion from the sale of Chelsea Football Club and send it to humanitarian causes in Ukraine. The government has granted a licence for that to happen, but the money is currently frozen because negotiations are deadlocked with the Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich. And in tennis, the men's number one Carlos Alcaraz has announced he's splitting with his coach unexpectedly. Juan Carlos Ferrero has worked with the 22-year-old since he was a teenager, and during that time Alcaraz has won 24 titles, including 6 Grand Slams. Don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today. An exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles at Wix. There's a kitchen to suit every home, with prices starting from under £3,000. Start planning your new kitchen. Book a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It is 25 minutes to 4. We are interviewing the interviewer now for the next half hour, one of the best in the business. Andrew Billen has 40 years of experience getting interviews with celebrities, politicians and writers. Just this year, the actor David Suchet admitted to Andrew he wasn't the easiest to work with. Zach Polanski, the leader of the Green Party, told him the Prime Minister was running scared. Presenter Steph McGovern told him about how she was stalked. And the comedian Paul Merton was prepared to explain how his wife died and how he then went through heartbreak and found love again. That's just some of many. It's not an uncomplicated job these days. Sometimes before you hear an interview here on Times Radio or read one in the paper, there has been quite a bit of back and forth between the interviewee and the celebrity's PR team about their often very specific requirements. Well, do you ignore the agreements once the interview started or give up on the idea of the interview altogether? Today, we're going to turn the tables and ask Andrew to give us a behind-the-scenes look at the realities of reporting on celebrities and what it is like travelling the country to sit at coffee tables or their homes with various famous faces. Here to look back across the year at the people he's met and the people we've lost. Feature writer for The Times, Andrew, is here. Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a very weird position to be in, suddenly to have to answer the questions.
And there is a wealth of things we could ask you about because I went on The Times app and you can search by an author. So I put your name in to sort of have a look at who you'd interviewed. There were over 2,700 articles that came up.
That can't be true.
It's true. Unless there's an error with how it's accounting for on the app. I thought, my goodness, where do we start? So can you just give us a little bit of a behind the scenes of the last year, really, and the process you go through in trying to get one of those celebrities or politicians or people who've been in the news to trust you to actually tell them your story?
Well, there are two stages, and the first stage I'm not really involved with. I mean, I do have ideas about who I'd like to interview, and sometimes they happen, but really they're prepared by my editors, who work incredibly hard to persuade PRs, generally, to let me interview their clients. And I sometimes see the email trail, and there might be 30 or 40 emails actually to get this one-hour session I finally get with this person who probably everybody wants to talk to and probably doesn't particularly want to talk to anybody, him or herself.
There's always a bit of a quid pro quo, isn't there? They want to sell something or promote something and you want the story. When are there just demands that you think this is actually unworkable?
I was doing Vic Reeves a year ago, and he was going to be talking about this programme on bird watching and painting birds, which was fine, and I was certainly going to ask him about it. But it became apparent on the train down through his PR, who I don't blame at all, that he really just didn't want to talk about anything else. So when I got there, it was sticky. And I always ask about the product because I understand, as you say, it's a quid pro quo. And also it's the latest thing they've done. And when you meet somebody you haven't seen for a while or don't know, you usually say, what have you been doing today? What's your next project? But then I have to professionally plow on because I'm not just there to have a coffee and a nice chat and become friends.
You're not writing an advert.
I'm not writing an advert, nor do I need a new friend. Yeah. You know? So I'm there to get some interesting stuff. And it wasn't unreasonable, I felt, to ask about his previous career as this very extraordinary cult comedian. He's doing this very gentle thing now with birds and painting, and it's a beautiful programme. But some of the Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer stuff was very it was quite violent and nasty and weird. And of course, I wanted to get into that. And so it was a frankly uncomfortable hour. But I think in the end, the PRs were pleased with it, and my editor was pleased enough.
How much has that whole process changed in the time that you've been working?
I think you sort of step back, and the motor of it is a bit different now. When I was on The Observer in the 90s, I could be flown out to New York to interview Mel Gibson and then go over to the West Coast and interview Shirley MacLaine. They both had products to sell, Braveheart and her latest biography, I think, autobiography. They had to do that if they wanted people to know about their book or their film. They had to go through the press. And that was at risk. I got into a row with Shirley MacLaine on whether she or didn't really believe in little green men, i.e. that we had been visited by aliens. Mel wanted to talk, obviously, about Braveheart. I wanted to touch on his alcoholism. But there was an understanding that you couldn't have the plug without the story. But since then, what's changed in the last 10 years is there's a much, much easier way to get people to know about your movie or your new book. You do a 10-second TikTok,
yep,
and it goes viral. Or you do a controversial tweet, or a photograph goes big on Instagram. No, you don't then have to put your client in front of a sceptical, maybe cynical journalist who's trying to wriggle out bits of these people's lives that they don't want to divulge.
So that's fascinating, isn't it? Because it tells us something about the people who do still agree to sitting down with Andrew Billen for an hour or so. What do you think that thing is?
I think some of them like talking about themselves. Authors are very good. I think you might have discovered this, because they sit behind a laptop for 18 months writing their book. It's a very solitary, lonely life. And then you get somebody who wants to come along and talk about their life and their book. They want to talk, generally. They've got a lot to say, and they're not asked about it all that often. So that's certainly one motive. I interviewed Hannah Fry, I'd say the TV scientist, but, you know, a brilliant woman, probably the most brilliant person I interviewed this year. And we were about, and this happens sometimes, after about 5 or 10 minutes, she said, "This feels like therapy." And I apologised. But she said, "No, that's good. Let's go on. Let's go into this. How did this introvert little girl become this massively popular, famous scientist? And where did the confidence come from?" And it turned out the confidence came from having got a PhD in fluid dynamics, I think, from Cambridge.
Yeah, and she said, "Don't patronise me." I think, look, I've got this incredible PhD. Yeah.
She did say, "Don't patronise me."
To the audience that we were reading.
No, she was patronised appallingly.
She has been. Yeah, it was. Well, you teased that out brilliantly. Mm. You have a different experience of interviewing than we do have it in the radio studio, because you're sat right in front of someone with a microphone. If you do have that awkward moment, I can't remember the adjective that you used before, but it was so good when you said it got. I can't remember. Like, there was a squeeze or it felt uncomfortable. You also have a more privileged position in some ways, because you have got time to think about it, to write it down, and you don't have to deliver it right in front of them. So if you've got a slightly unfavourable thing to say, you can. What are you weighing up if you're going to write something that isn't going to put someone in the best light or the light they were imagining?
I think it's changed over my career. As you pointed out, I've been doing it for decades now, probably 30 years, 35 years as an interviewer on national newspapers. When I joined that sort of strange gang of celebrity interviewers, the chief among us was a woman called Lynn Barber, who was famous for the viciousness of her interviews and her willingness to say anything bad. And it, in a strange way, people were attracted to this, because they thought, can I woo this woman? Can I get her to say something nice about me in print? So I think most of us were slightly over-influenced by that. And gradually you learn that that's not the, for me anyway, the best way to get stuff out of people. But how would I like it to be treated like a monster? Because monsters come from somewhere. And I won't say I tried to make it more like a conversation, because I think in a way that's dishonest. But I do think I try to come in with less of an agenda and better questions. And that's something I learned from this programme, actually, because the questions asked by Fee and Jane, and I'm sure by Rosie, and they have been already, are original, come at a different angle, and that can slightly crack people open, and they can be really revealing if you ask and bother to prepare the right question.
It's a very nice thing he's just said, isn't it? Do you think he's warming us up
before
he writes something absolutely terrible about us? Do you know, the funny thing about Lynn Barber, Andrew, I interviewed her, she had a book out, didn't she? Mm. She wrote her memoir about her extraordinary childhood. I expected her to be slightly different in the flesh, because I thought maybe her skewering of people was what she did at work, it was her day job, but it was absolutely her, actually, wasn't it? And it was one of the most uncomfortable interviews I think I've ever had to do, because she just wasn't interested in the kind of fluff around anything, was she? She was just like, nope, don't want to answer that. Nope, you've asked that wrong. It was just blooming terrifying. That's right. This is going much better, I hope, so far. And can we talk about some of the people that you've met this year? Because when you interview people, when that person, you know, is in our sight line, it is for a reason. It tells us something about our times. And actually, we were talking just before we came on air about an interview that you did with Kate Clanchy, which I think really does tell a story of something that's happened over the last 5 years or so. So tell us a little bit about her.
Yes, well, I interviewed Kate Clanchy in 2019, I think, and she'd just was about to publish a memoir. And it was about her experience as a teacher in Oxford, teaching poetry to refugees, asylum seekers, from boys and girls from Africa. And she was being hailed as an absolute miracle worker. She was getting this fantastic poetry out of these young people who came, as she pointed out, from great storytelling traditions themselves that she was ignorant of and then learnt about. And she went. That book went on to win the Orwell Prize. And then in, I think it was the first summer of lockdown, things went completely mad. A group of people, a very small group of people, three of them female authors some kind of ethnic background, accused of racism. They use this terrible phrase, white saviour complex. And within a few weeks, her career was pretty much destroyed. Her publishers sided with the critics. They apologised several times to them for the offence caused. Kate became extremely anxious and depressed by this, to the point where she came very near. She didn't to attempting suicide by using pills that were in her bathroom because she'd been looking after her very sick and now dead parents. She was saved by a phone call from a friend. She then went to talk to her publishers. It was lockdown. It was very hard to see anybody in person, and I think that sort of exaggerated this moral panic. She went to see them, and to her horror, three of the most senior people in the publishing house, people who had refused to defend her, admitted they hadn't actually read the book, at which point she burst into tears. So I interviewed her again. We kept in touch. This is one of the things. I don't make friends from doing interviews, but I do keep in touch with some of those people. And she got in touch with me a few months ago and said, there is going to be a podcast about this. Would you like to interview me about my story? And the reason we could do it was because she had uncovered through the Agency of Freedom of Information all the emails that had been sent about the affair by her publishers and the publicists. And it was an extraordinary and appalling story. And it ended up, obviously, the publishers didn't want to speak to me about it. I put everything to them. And on practically the day I was finishing the piece, I got an email at 5 PM saying, we've just talked to our chief executive. We're going to apologise.
And it was a full apology, wasn't it?
I rang Kate immediately. She was actually doing a tutorial, and there was just silence. And she said, I've been waiting for this for 4 years.
It is quite the story. By the way, anybody can go back, and I'm just going to sound so corporate now. My apologies. If you've got a digital subscription, you can go back through the archive and you can read Andrew's interviews, all the people who we're talking about today. We do tend to contact you as well when people have died, Andrew, and I think that's the last time that we spoke to you on this programme. And we lost Tom Stoppard. It's a very odd phrase, that, isn't it? We lost. Tom Stoppard died this year, and I know that you had interviewed him, met him several times during his lifetime. So how do you balance that personal sense of somebody going with the professional need to then absolutely tell the truth about the whole of their life?
There's a little bit more freedom, isn't there, because they've died and they're not going to complain. But there's also a great tide of affection from me towards somebody like Tom Stoppard, who was I don't need to say this, he was a great, great man. but also a kind interviewee. He used to be a journalist himself, and it was a pleasure meeting him on both occasions. The problem was he didn't want to talk about himself very much. And on that first occasion, which was when Shakespeare in Love came out, the script of which he had written and went on to win Oscars, he wouldn't talk about his background at all. And 20 years later, when I see him again, he's a little bit more forthcoming about how he Czechoslovakian, spent some of his childhood in Singapore, India, and then comes over with a stepfather who doesn't seem to like. He was slightly more forthcoming about that, but not all that much. And anyway, he was in a terrible mood because he had writer's block. And then he writes Leopoldstadt, which is all about his family, his Jewish background. And I just realised when I put in the piece that he was right. He was right not to talk to me about all that stuff, because he's the wordsmith. He's the guy with the insights and the talent. And he wrote about himself in the years before he died.
What strategies do you use when you are face to face with someone and you ask those questions and there is a real reluctance?
The first thing you do is pause to see whether they're going to say anything more. And then I say, that's interesting. Why don't you want to talk about that? Because sometimes the quote about why they won't give you a quote works as a quote. And you try a couple more times, and then you leave it. And because I've got the luxury that you two don't, of having an hour, you know, not 10 minutes. And sometimes they circle back and they say, I do want to say something about that thing you asked me about.
And do you think as well that the job becomes easier the older you get, just because you know more about everything that is the human life? Or maybe it gets harder because you lose the brashness of youth? What do you reckon?
That's a typically brilliant question. I think I used to work with a fantastic photographer called Jane Bowne, who was extremely nervous, even in her 70s, about taking a photograph. And I said, you've done this 1,000 times, Jane. Why are you worried? And she says, because I know what can go wrong. And I feel like that now. I have no idea how an interview is going to go. You know, when you knock at the door, you go into the hotel room, you don't know if you're going to be met with enthusiasm or hostility. So the worry factor doesn't decline. On the other hand, I think looking older, having grey hair, you know, sometimes my interviewees say, I used to read you in the Observer when I was growing up, which makes me feel very, very old. I think they trust me a bit more. And I'm sure some people say I've stitched them up. But I hope more of them will say, well, at least he quoted me accurately.
Yeah, I'm sure, and I'm sure you would do that. We would never question that. I always love the location that people pick for these. It's surely best to be in someone's home where they're most comfortable, but maybe that's giving up quite a lot of themselves to let you see, you know, their house. Or as Fee was saying earlier, when we were preparing for this programme, seeing someone's bathroom really does tell you quite a lot about them.
They're always much more angry if you made fun of their bathroom than if you made fun of their careers, in my experience. Because you used to do that a lot. You used to get invited to their homes.
Whose homes, you know, have you seen?
Whose homes have I seen? Actresses, authors. The really big ones like Mel Gibson, you'd see in a hotel room or a restaurant. Ian McEwan, for example, I think is still happy for me to meet in his flat in London, and I regard him as a writer almost up there with Stoppard. But it's great. They're a bit more relaxed, and it's less easy for them to throw you out somehow because they're your host. But it happens less and less now. It's much more controlled. I hate having a PR in the room. I used to say, if you're in the room and you'll be in the piece if you start talking.
do they interfere? Or are there wide eyes in the background?
Occasionally they'll say, I think we should move on. Or I was interviewing Woody Allen once, and this PR kept saying, back to the movie, which was a shame because Woody Allen was quite happy to talk about his personal life.
And there's quite a lot to talk about.
There was lots to talk about. And weirdly enough, Woody was happy enough to talk about it.
Who's the one that got away, the person you've always wanted to interview but haven't got to?
I really wanted to interview David Letterman, who was the late night chat show host on CBS for decades. He had a really interesting career. He'd been passed over for the top job, set up shop on another network, and then got into terrible trouble because he was blackmailed for an affair he was having with a junior member of staff. I just thought he had a fantastic story, and he was a very complicated man who apparently was very funny but would agonise after every programme, play the tape, worry that he'd missed the joke and all that. But he just didn't do interviews, really.
Mm. We've had a message from Susan who says one of my favourite Andrew Bullen articles was about himself and how he found love.
That's very nice of her.
Yeah.
If I'd wanted to be a columnist, I could have done a lot of that stuff talking about myself. But it doesn't really interest me as much as finding out about other people. But on the other hand, if the desk rings up and says, "Would you write about how you met your wife on online dating?" and she turned out to be another journalist and she turned out to be on a story, I'll happily write that piece because I don't have to do any research.
That's true. No background. Yeah, that's brilliant.
No cuttings.
Can you give us any glimpse of what's to come in 2026? Interviews in the pipeline?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say.
There we go.
Only because I've got to go down and face my editor in a few minutes. And if I say I'm interviewing somebody to some other paper, may say, well, that's a good idea.
Let's not spoil everything.
Generally, I don't know.
Thank you so much, Andrew Bullen. It has been such a pleasure. Feature editor at The Times, and as we've said, yeah, head online. There's a lengthy archive of some fantastic interviews to look through. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you very much.
But you know that the one that everyone's going to go for is the one about you. Very happy Christmas to you as
Merry
well.
Christmas
thank
to you
for
both.
Coming to see us. It is 4:04. This is Fee and Rosie on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now for Christmas in bookshops everywhere and online.
Christmas on Times Radio.
Yeah, the bells are back, which means Christmas really has been ringing in.
I'm loving it, Rosie. I love the Christmas jingles.
Yeah, they're good. I've got another carol service this evening. I think number 6. And then there's one more on Friday. I had my big community choir's big concert late last night. So it was so exciting not have to get up at 3:00 in the morning, but instead something like 8:00 to come and join you in the afternoon instead, which is a real pleasure.
Well, it's nice to see you in daylight hours.
Absolutely. Well, just about as it starts to get dark as we sort of ring in Christmas. It has been such a pleasure to be here. That is it from us today. We will be back tomorrow from 2:00. Don't forget that you can hear even more of us on the daily podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee, available wherever you get your podcasts from. And it's coming up to sort of the end of Christmas term, really.
It is. So this this programme will take a little bit of a hiatus over the Christmas season. So Rosie and I will be doing the last live show in this kind of combo tomorrow. And I'm delighted to say, actually, at 3:30, Chris McCausland is our guest, talking about how AI and technology is enabling his future to be brighter than ever. So don't miss that.
That is going to be brilliant. We'll be back then tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Our producer today was Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it is John Pina with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, guys. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pina, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The government is threatening Roman Abramovich with legal action to use the funds from selling Chelsea Football Club to help humanitarian groups in Ukraine. And the UK could end up paying £870 million a year to be a member of the EU student exchange scheme Erasmus. Now, coming up, we know Keir Starmer is having a tough time at the top of the Labour Party, but is it about to get tougher? The party's biggest union in terms of donations is now being run by a staunch critic. We're going to have a good look. Resident doctors are out on the picket line now. I'll be talking to Health Trust, to NHS England and to the Dispute Resolution Service, ACAS, to take the, well, you're looking for maybe a role to take some sort of heat out of this and find a compromise. We will find out. And how much of a problem are the Freemasons for the Metropolitan Police?
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. The government is threatening Roman Abramovich with legal action to use the funds from selling Chelsea Football Club to help humanitarian causes in Ukraine. The Russian billionaire was allowed to sell the club in 2022, provided the funds went towards victims of Russia's full-scale invasion. However, the funds have been frozen since then, with negotiations deadlocked. Sir Keir Starmer told MPs during Prime Minister's questions the government has now issued a licence to transfer that money.
My message to Abramovich is this: the clock is ticking. Honour the commitment that you made and pay up now. And if you don't, we're prepared to go to court so every penny reaches those whose lives have been torn apart by Putin's illegal war.
Mr. Abramovich is understood to want some of the funds to go to Russia, arguing that would benefit who he sees as all the victims of the war. Sir Keir Starmer has called resident doctor strikes in England dangerous and utterly irresponsible. They started their walkout this morning with the British Medical Association calling on the government to offer a bigger pay rise. People will now be arrested if they chant "Globalise the Intifada" at pro-Palestinian marches in London and in Manchester.
We know communities are concerned about placards and chants such as "Globalise the Intifada." And those using it at future protests or in a targeted way should expect the Met or Greater Manchester Police to take immediate action. Violence acts have taken place. The context has changed. Words have meanings. Words have consequences. We will act decisively. We will make arrests.
The Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, says while the chants haven't previously met prosecuting thresholds, officers will now use updated guidance after the Bondi Beach shooting in Australia. Intifada is an Arabic word for rebellion, which has been linked to Palestinian uprisings. However, some Jewish groups consider it an anti-Semitic call to violence. A 15-year-old boy has appeared in court charged with the murder of a 9-year-old girl in Somerset. On Monday evening, Aria Thorpe was found dead at a property in Weston-super-Mare with a single stab wound. She celebrated her 9th birthday 2 weeks ago. Superintendent Jen Appleford has asked the public not to speculate about the killing.
This remains an incredibly difficult time for Aria's family. It is impossible to adequately describe how traumatic the past 36 hours have been for them.
The UK could end up paying £870 million a year to be a member of the EU student exchange scheme Erasmus. The government has reached an agreement for British students to rejoin the scheme with a 30% discount for the 2027-28 academic year. That means the government will pay £570 million for that year, but EU diplomats have suggested that discount will not last beyond then.
And Freemasons are taking legal action against the Metropolitan Police over plans to force officers to declare if they've been a member or currently are a member. Bodies representing Freemasons across the UK say the policy is discriminatory and could breach human rights, but the Met says the move is aimed at improving transparency and public trust. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, thanks for joining me. I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Whoever in the Labour Party imagined that government would be easy? Well, no one, presumably, and certainly no one with any sense. Locked into a pay dispute with striking doctors, a wave of union militancy building in the public services, and now, today, a new hardline leader elected to lead one of those big unions, Unison. And I'm going to tell you more about that in just a moment. Keir Starmer's government maybe needs more than luck. It needs help. But now, just as we come on air, help may, just may, be at hand. NHS bosses have been calling on the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to take the doctors' dispute to arbitration at ACAS. Well, will he agree to that? Will the doctors agree to that? And here is another question. Has ACAS got involved already, offering to help find a compromise and a deal? I'm going to be talking live to the Director of Dispute Resolution at ACAS in a moment to try to learn more. And meanwhile, what has certainly come as unwelcome news in Downing Street earlier, the giant public sector union Unison has elected a hardline left-wing militant as its leader. Adrian Egan was expelled from the Labour Party for liking Marxist messages on social media. She's pledged to hold the government's feet to the fire, which is, after all, the job of a public sector union leader. But Adrian Egan seems to mean it. And by the way, would life be any easier for the government facing public pay demands just now, whoever was leading the unions? Let's talk about that. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, there is some good news, at least if you're a student keen to study in Europe for a year, as happened before Brexit. The government has struck a deal with the EU to make that easier. I'm going to be talking to the Cabinet Minister, Nick Thomas-Symonds, live about the deal, about the cost, about where it all goes from here. First then, Keir Starmer's control over Labour, it has been, you know, it seems maybe weakened significantly. One of his key backers has been ousted by a left-wing union leader. The grassroots activist, Adrian Egan, promised to review Unison's relationship with Labour after ousting the incumbent General Secretary, Christina McKinnay, in an election. Oliver Wright is the policy editor at The Times. Hello, see you, Oliver.
Hello.
Hi, Ollie. So, well, Downing Street, I ain't going to say it out loud, but in their hearts, ministers, in the government, they must surely have sunk those hearts on the news that a left-wing militant is now at the top of Unison, surely.
Yeah, I think there would have been a groan all round in Downing Street on this news. I mean, they've been really hoping that the current General Secretary of Unison remained in post. But obviously, as you said earlier, Andrea Egan got that job. She won 60% of the vote. Now, why does it matter? It matters in part because Unison is one of the biggest donors to Labour. In the run-up to the election, it gave £1.49 million to the party to help fund that campaign. And there is a question mark over, you know, whether that money will be forthcoming in the future. Egan has made it clear that, you know, if that money comes at all, it certainly won't come without strings attached to it. And then the second thing is really about Starmer's own control over the Labour apparatus. You know, the way in which the Labour Party is structured, its ruling National Executive Committee has a significant portion of union representative on it. And Starmer needs allies on that body in order to enforce his will across the party. And if you have unions that are not sympathetic to the leadership, that makes life for Starmer very, very difficult.
I mean, clearly so. And so now we have Unison led by a pretty tough new General Secretary. And that's alongside the other big, big union in the public services. That's Unite, which is led, of course, by Sharon Graham, who's not always by any means minded to be obliging to Keir Starmer's government.